Tanisan doubles down. Ding dong, chimed the PA system for the umpteenth time. Here is an important passenger announcement. All international and domestic flights are suspended until further notice due to technical issues beyond our control. We apologize for any inconvenience this may cause. Tanisan gave a groan and shifted impatiently in her seat. Impatient being the key word here. This was a person who would shake the leaves off her ginkgo tree if they didn't fall off in a timely fashion, so imagine how she felt after being stuck in the departure lounge of Haneda Airport for the last 3.5 hours. Her friend, Mrs. Ishihama, was with her, but then she was quite happy to sit there counting the floor tiles. They were on their way to Sapporo to attend the funeral of an old school friend who'd been stung on the uvula by an undercooked wasp cracker. However, while they were there, they also hoped to visit the statue of Dr. William Clark, because they'd had a bet with each other as to what he was pointing at. A sheep's bottom, guessed Mrs. Ish. Right now, though, Tanisan was bored. Really bored. She'd visited all the shops in the departure lounge, read every single one of the several meaningful sentences in her glossy fashion magazine, and had made a Danish pastry last for nigh on 20 minutes. So finally she was forced to fall back on her emergency pastime, which was getting Mrs. Ishihama to believe something really stupid. "Have you ever wondered," began Tanisan in a casual and roundabout sort of way, "what happened to the crazy frog?" "Oh, yes," said her friend with a solemn nod. "It often has me waking up in a cold sweat during the wee small hours." "Funny, though, isn't it?" said Tanisan. "For a long time the blessed thing was everywhere. Then it suddenly disappeared without trace. I read in a recent edition of Time magazine that once these fads reach a certain level of public nuisance, they're isolated, contained, and transported to a purpose-built storage facility in the north of England. They've got secret trains and container ships full of this stuff going in and out under cover of darkness." "Oh, what sort of stuff?" asked Mrs. Ish, who was already fully invested in the idea. "All sorts," said Tanisan. "Songs, ringtones, fashion trends, even the odd celebrity or two. Anything or anyone that causes undue distress to the general public." "So how do they get the celebrities to go in there?" was Mrs. Ishihama's next question. "They trap them in toilet cubicles," explained Tanisan. Her dim friend considered this for a moment, and although it was a bit of a stretch, finally managed to reconcile it with her overall world view. "So tell me this," she then inquired. "Do they have Gangnam Style safely contained?" "They do," said Tanisan. "It's securely locked away in a sealed flask under the North Sea." "Well, thank heavens for that," said a relieved Mrs. Ishihama, who was the only person Tanisan had ever known to fail a personality test. "I wouldn't care to imagine the consequences if that got out. It wouldn't be pretty, I can tell you." "Yes, well, it's funny you should say that, because that's precisely the sort of problem they have to contend with on a daily basis," said Tanisan. "You see, some of the older parts of the facility date all the way back to the 1950s and are not up to the job. Quite recently, several irritating expressions leaked out through a culvert and infected the English language, going forward being one of them. But worst of all was an incident that occurred back in 1977, when a group of terrorists broke into the facility, got hold of a particularly unpleasant variant of the West Country accent, and threatened to release it in the home counties unless their demands were met." "Oh, no," said a startled Mrs. Ish. "What happened?" "What happened," said Tanisan. "Complete panic throughout the southeast of England. That's what happened, particularly among the chattering classes. As for the money markets, they feared a drop in stock price if a rustic accent were to take hold of their industry. Fortunately, the authorities were able to limit the outbreak to a small village in Surrey, although they didn't reckon on one thing." "Oh," said Mrs. Ishihama, "and what was that?" "Starlings," said Tanisan. "Starlings?" said Mrs. Ish. "Starlings," said Tanisan. "There was a flock of them roosting in a patch of woodland next to the village green. You know, where they burn witches and play cricket. Opposite the mill pond that always has two swans and the little red telephone box that drunks go to the toilet in. If it had been any other type of bird, it wouldn't have mattered as much. But as any ornithologist worth his salt will tell you, One of the most striking characteristics of your common starling, apart from its iridescent hues, is that it's a superb mimic. So they flew about in their captivating murmurations, spreading the pernicious accent far and wide, which is why everyone in the UK sounds like a dairy farmer. It's called cross-species transmission. Having come to the end of her little entertainment, Tanis-Anne got up and wandered over to the observation window to look down on the aircraft, which were parked here and there on the tarmac, doing nothing. "You know," she said as Mrs. Ish joined her there, "it wouldn't surprise me if something similar has happened here. I mean, what if the avian flu virus has crossed over from birds to other flying things, like aeroplanes? Can you imagine what that would do to the travel industry? I suppose they'd have to destroy all of these aircraft just to make sure that they didn't infect other forms of public transport." She left Mrs. Ishihama to ponder on the implications of that and wandered off to find the ladies. Afterwards, she spent some time browsing in the bookstore, followed by another visit to the 7-Eleven to stock up on snacks. But then as she was emerging from said outlet with a large melon soda and a big green bag of seaweed-flavoured potato chips, she was apprehended by two policemen. "Would you mind coming with us, madam?" said the taller one, a spotty youth. So then they took her by the elbows and led her off to the terminal police station, while groups of passengers looked on in alarm. "Well, well," said Tanis-Anne, as she was bundled along wearing an expression that fell somewhere on the scale between surprise and delight. "This is a turn-up for the books, isn't it? I wonder where this is going." "Come and see how the state treats its citizens," she called out to anyone who would listen. "I am innocent, yet I stand accused. This could be you," she warned, directing this final remark at a startled 5-year-old who was stood nearby with his parents. They checked her in at the desk and then led her down a corridor to the room at the end. Inside there were two chairs and a table. There was a senior police officer sat on one side with his serious face on, being all serious. He motioned her to sit. She did so. "A passport and boarding pass, please," he said, holding out a hand. Tanis-Anne delved into her shoulder bag and handed him the requested items. Truth be told, she was glad of the diversion. It would kill a bit of time. The officer in question, a stocky man with bad skin and a single bar on his epaulettes, glanced at her passport photo and then at her. "So, Mrs. Tanny," he then said, putting her travel documents to one side, "I'm Inspector Sakai. I'm in charge here. Perhaps you would care to explain to me why the person you're travelling with would actively seek out one of my officers in order to tell him that if he wanted to know why all the flights had been delayed, he should talk to you, because you were very clever and knew everything there was to know about the virus." Tanis-Anne gave a heavy sigh. "Of course she did," she muttered resignedly. "So you admit it then," said the inspector. "You were discussing a virus in relation to the ongoing situation at this airport." Now, there were two ways that Tanis-Anne could have gone with this. On the one hand, nothing would have been easier for her than to clear up the whole misunderstanding with a few well-chosen words. Obviously, the authorities were having to contend with an actual virus of some sort, otherwise she wouldn't be sitting there now. So all she had to do was to explain to him that she had, in fact, been making a silly joke about bird flu to a very stupid person. Yet for the purposes of her own entertainment, she decided instead to incriminate herself even further, just to see what would happen. "Yes," she said, "quite right. That's exactly what I was doing." "Then I should warn you that unless you're able to furnish me with a satisfactory explanation, you may find yourself in a lot of trouble." "I don't think so," said Tanis-Anne. "Excuse me? I don't think I'll find myself in a lot of trouble," she shrugged. "That sort of thing doesn't happen to me. I always get away with it, no matter what I do." "Well, not this time," said the policeman, clearly annoyed by her nonchalant attitude. "Interfering with the safe operation of air traffic control is a very serious offence." "Ah," thought Tanis-Anne, "so it was a computer virus then." "Well," she said, "that may be true for other people, but not me. I'm a special case." Inspector Sakai peered across the table at her, momentarily disarmed by her bizarre response. Then he grabbed her passport and headed for the door. Poking his head out into the corridor, he summoned over one of his junior officers and handed it to her. "Oh, we may have a problem," he muttered under his breath. "Find out if there's any previous." Oh, and while you're at it, called out Tanisanne, who was eavesdropping, obviously, we could do with a pen and paper for when we get around to the subject of discussing my demands. It'll save you an extra journey. So the officer went away and returned a few moments later with a pen and a notepad. Inspector Sakai returned to the table with them and sat down opposite his unusual suspect. Then, in a clumsy attempt to change the dynamic, he leant in towards her and tried to adopt a calmer, friendlier, less confrontational approach. "Look, Mrs. Tanny," he began in his most reasonable voice, "let me lay all my cards on the table here. I'm going to say something to you now that I wouldn't normally admit to anyone in your position." "All right," said Tanisanne, "but before you do, may I offer you one piece of advice? That smile of yours doesn't have the effect that you seem to think it does. There's a touch of the Noriegas about it." "Yes, all right, thanks for bringing that to my attention," he said. "The point I'm trying to make is this. I usually have very good instincts when it comes to people, and what I'm getting from you is that you're not some crazed cyber-terrorist hell-bent on bringing down the system, but a nice, normal, law-abiding lady. You're not a troublemaker who delights in mischief." "Well," said Tanisanne, "that's one point of view, I suppose. But here's the problem," he went on. "I have to investigate every lead that comes across my desk, no matter how unlikely. In your case, for example, I'm almost 100% sure that you're not the person we're looking for. However, you are the only suspect that we have in custody at the present time. So please, just help me to eliminate you from our inquiries so we can get on with the business of tracking down the real culprits." "Fair enough," said Tanisanne. "So we agree then." "Of course," she said. "I'll tell you everything you want to know." "Good. Once you've written down my demands." "No, no," said Sakai. "We don't need to do that, do we? Because we've already established that you're not responsible." "Well, you say that, but by your own admission, you're not 100% sure." "Well, no one can be 100% sure." "And that's the sort of attitude we should expect from our police service, is it?" said Tanisanne. "No wonder the Chinese are laughing at us. So tell me this," she then went on. "Would it be all right for children to travel on a school bus if the driver wasn't 100% sure that the brakes would work?" "No, of course not," he said. "No," concurred Tanisanne. "And yet that same high standard doesn't apply when an entire airport has been brought to a standstill by a terrorist threat, it seems." "Look," said the inspector, "all I'm asking you to do is to answer a few simple questions to clear your name. And I will, once you've taken down my demands." "But there's no need for demands, is there?" "Why not?" asked Tanisanne. "What would be the point of causing all this travel disruption if there were no demands?" "Because you're not the terrorist." "Of course not," said Tanisanne. "So why do I have to answer your stupid questions in the first place?" At this, Inspector Sakai finally lost his temper and grabbed the notepad and pen. All right," he said, just wanting to move things along. "I'll write down your demands if it'll make you happy. What are they then?" So then Tanisanne popped another seaweed-flavoured potato chip into her mouth and tilted her head to one side. She mused. "Let me think. Okay, listen carefully, for you will face three challenges. Firstly, you will venture forth to northern India and, risking many dangers, find the legendary stone begging bowl of the Buddha himself. Secondly, you will travel to the floating mountain of Horai, where grows a tree that bears fruit of the finest jade, and bring back a single branch thereof. Finally, you will find or have fashioned a wondrous robe made from the shimmering pelts of Chinese fire rats." "Well, go on then," she urged him, waving a salty finger about. "Write it down." Inspector Sakai just looked at her and put down his pen. "No," he said. "What do you mean, no?" said Tanisanne, thoroughly enjoying his non-compliance. "Well, no in the sense that I won't be writing that down any time this century," he said, having recognised, as any Japanese person would, the references to the Heian fairy story, The Tale of the Bamboo Cutter. "This may come as something of a surprise to you, Mrs. Tanny," he said, "but the purview of the Metropolitan Police Department does not extend to legends, fairy tales, or mythical quests. So here's what I'll do instead. I'll leave you in here for a while to stew in your own juice, and when I come back, perhaps you'll be a bit more willing to cooperate." So the inspector left her there and went off to find out what his colleagues had managed to uncover on her background. However, as he was heading into the office, a call came in for him from his superior, Superintendent Ito, who was anxious to know what progress was being made with the investigation. He'd been informed that Sakai had a suspect in custody, but when the latter then tried to explain to him that in his opinion, Tanisan was a time waster, the superintendent didn't want to know. Instead, he ordered the inspector to hold her there until someone from the Cyber Affairs Bureau or the Public Security Intelligence Agency had had a chance to question her. Apparently, they would be arriving within the next few minutes. When he returned to the interview room, he found Tanisan happily tapping away on the keyboard of her smartphone, which the arresting officers had failed to confiscate. And when he asked her what she was doing, she glanced at him and twitched her nose. "Well," she said, "I thought I'd better let my friend know where I was. And then I got into an interesting discussion on social media. I've just been explaining to them that I'm being held at the airport under suspicion of terrorism. And guess what? Now they want to know what my demands are. So I'm just telling them." "You're doing what?" asked Sakai, utterly aghast. "Don't worry," said Tanisan. "I wasn't happy with the fairy tale ones either. I've changed them. What I'm demanding now is that the 10 most irritating expressions in Japanese are removed from the dictionary by midnight. We're all just trying to agree on what they are." Just then, one of the officers that had arrested Tanisan put his head into the room, a look of alarm plastered across his broad, shiny face. "Sir," he said, "I think you'd better see this." So once again, Inspector Sakai left her alone in the interview room and followed his subordinate out into the corridor to where a group of officers had gathered around a television set that was mounted on a bracket in a corner of the room. They were watching a live bulletin from NHK News. The rolling ticker tape at the top of the screen read, "Airport terrorist issues bizarre demands on social media." "Why didn't you tell me that you'd been talking to the media?" asked Sakai, having rushed back to the interview room to confront Tanisan about it. "I haven't," she said, still quietly tapping away on the keyboard of her phone. "Yes, you have. You've been talking to NHK." "Oh," said Tanisan, only half listening. "When they said they were from NHK, I thought they meant the automotive spring manufacturer." "What?" he exclaimed. "Why would a spring manufacturer be interested in your terrorist demands?" However, before he could elicit anything like a semi-sensible answer from her, the door burst open and in marched his boss's boss, Deputy Commissioner Hara, a squat, sinister figure with swept-back hair and dark glasses. He was accompanied by a boyish-looking plainclothes officer from Domestic Intelligence who just stood in a corner talking on his cell phone. "All right, Inspector," growled the Deputy Commissioner. "Excellent job. We'll take it from here." "But, sir," protested Sakai. Unfortunately, that was as far as he got with that sentence, for the bullish DC threw an arm around his shoulder and steered him off to one side, away from the prying ears of Tanisan. "Listen, man," he hissed, "you overstepped your authority by a country mile, and by rights should be drummed out of the force with nothing to show for it but one of my steel-capped size nines wedged firmly up your fundament. But luckily for you, your plan worked, which is one in the eye for those panty sniffers at Homeland Security. This could mean a big promotion for you, Sakai. We always need men of your ilk who are willing to take imbecilic risks with their careers and go off at a complete tangent." "But I don't understand, sir," said the inspector. "What is it that I'm supposed to have done?" "What has he done, he asks," grinned the deputy commissioner, pinching the inspector's cheek. "The modesty of the fellow! Why, your brilliant plan of pretending to be the terrorist and putting your idiotic demands on the interweb, of course. Who could have guessed that the real culprits would get so upset at having their cause hijacked by a bunch of complete plonkers that they'd end up declaring themselves, thus allowing us to flush them out? It was an inspired piece of police work, Inspector, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if you receive a special commendation for being as smart as a brain pie. But in the meantime," he said, casting a quick glance in Tanisan's direction, "you'd better let that lady go and hope that she doesn't want to lodge a complaint against you." With a couple of hearty backslaps that almost sent the inspector's contact lenses flying through the air like a pair of UFOs, the deputy commissioner turned and marched straight out of the room, closely followed by the schoolboy's spook. For a moment, Sakai just stood there, blinking, as he struggled to get his head around what had just happened. Then, still in a sort of daze, he wandered over to the table and collapsed onto the chair opposite Tanisan. "See," she said with a shrug of her shoulders, I always get away with it.